Welcome to Hollywood Ungagged, the Brian Doherty of Political Podcasts. We've just finished recording. It was a really good podcast. We were under orders from Deborah to make sure we kept it tight and not kind of overrun, which we've kind of developed a habit of doing, which makes a bit of a headache for her when she's editing. So we were good boys and kept it time. I think it resulted in a better podcast, so I'm glad that she forced us to do that. We spoke a bit about the Gray, Sue Gray report that came out earlier today. You know, I managed to catch it this afternoon when my children were asleep, listening to Boris Johnson try to worm his way out of the fact that he's been caught having presiding over a culture of rule breaking. We spoke about some of the contributions from the opposition and some of the backbenchers in relation to that. We then spoke a wee bit about Ian Murray and his attempts to save the union by, you know, getting the civil service to refuse to obey the Scottish Government and to not implement the democratic manifesto that they were elected on. We then spoke about the cost of living crisis that's kind of upon us. Spoke about Jack Monroe, who created a Twitter thread that kind of became a campaign almost on its own. It picked up momentum really fast. And then we spoke about the latest as transphobic incidents in the UK, where the Equality and Human Rights Commission tried to get the Scottish Government to consult even further on the Gender Recognition Bill, despite the fact we've been consulting on it for at least since 2016. So I think that's all I've got to say. I hope you enjoy it, and let's get ungagged. And it was nice, nice to hear you smile. Dream a dream, cause you'll never die. The stars will never overtake the sky. Life has its turns and it takes a while. Nice, nice to meet you. Hello, and welcome to Hollywood Ungagged, the pro-indie podcast of lefties. I'm your host, David McClement, broadcasting from the Blantyre Free State, and I'm joined by my permanent companions. First of all, there's Deborah Torrance, my digital Michelangelo. How are you getting on there?
Doing all right, thank you very much. How are you, David?
Smashing. And also joining us is the Pizza Hut Prince of Falkirk, it is Brian Finlay.
Hello, hello.
How's things?
Good. Pretty sleepy, pretty tired.
Looking forward to going on holiday next week.
I am really, really, really looking forward to going on holiday next week. Very much so.
I'm so jealous.
Can't wait.
So stay tuned to see who will have subbing in for Brian next week. It's unconfirmed yet, but it might be a superstar. You never know. I'll just leave that hanging out there. I'm not saying it's Nicola Sturgeon. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying it isn't either. Wait and see.
I thought we were trying to get Sue Gray on.
Well, she's finished her report and she's maybe on annual leave, so maybe no.
She'll be a loose end now.
Yeah. She'll be taking up loads of these places, like panel shows and stuff like that. She'll start appearing on like 8 out of 10 cats and stuff, and they could be like, oh, don't write a report about this because it'll be awkward.
Who was the woman that was chairing the parish council?
Jackie Weaver.
She'll be the new Jackie Weaver. That's Jackie Weaver. Yeah. Will be bumped for all the student union appearances and stuff. Sue Gray will take all that sort of role.
We should be going around all the freshers' weeks, being like doing the opening and maybe giving like people like insight and ideas for how they can produce the perfect report for their classes and make sure they submit it, turn it in on time and stuff like that. You know.
Talking to Sue Gray, I think we should just get into the Gray report that came out today. Is it the Sue Gray report? People keep calling it Gray report, makes it sound too boring, I think. So the Sue Gray report came out earlier today. Some of the things that it pointed out was a failure of leadership in relation to all the Downing Street lockdown parties. There was 16 events. I think I've been saying 17, which I think was a good guess because I totally lost count of how many there were. And 12 of them are under police investigation. She highlighted that there was excessive consumption of alcohol in Downing Street, behaviour difficult to justify, and a serious failure to observe high standards expected. So pretty damning. Did you get a chance to see Boris Johnson in Parliament today and some of the questions that followed up? Brian, would you like to go for?
Yeah, so I did watch the statement from Boris Johnson, and it was interesting because there was very little speculation about what actually was going to happen. I think people genuinely had no idea. In the media, they were essentially like, we'll just have to wait and see what the Prime Minister says. And I mean, I didn't expect him to resign, but I didn't expect him to throw civil servants under the bus, like, is in really obvious and overt manner, basically wrapping the problem up in bureaucracy and how, for some reason, it's civil servants' responsibility or the downstreet office's responsibility to make sure that there's not parties in the Prime Minister's flat. It was really awkward to watch, I think. And he seemed to have got like that silly Boris Johnson bravado back as well, that he was trying to deflect completely from what the reality is. But I really think he's misjudged this. Again, I know we've spoken about this at length, as the sort of party gates developed and there's been cheese and wine and there's been birthday cakes and all this as it's kind of developed, and all that stuff really, really doesn't matter. And I think what really matters is what some of the MPs were talking about today. You had Hannah Burdell talking about constituents, who didn't get to see their dying loved ones at the same time as these parties were going on. The intricacies of the Downing Street parties really don't matter. There's so many of them now that it doesn't matter who was there, what happened. It's the fact that it was just so endemic and they thought that it was absolutely fine to be doing these things. And I just think now, the Prime Minister was hiding behind the Sue Gray report, and now that's been published, and you know that now the Met's sort of stepped in, you know, and they're doing their own criminal investigations. But for some reason, the Prime Minister was trying his best to deflect the fact that Downing Street and he and his colleagues are under police investigation. And that is actually just bonkers. And he's still trying to go out there swinging big, you know, being like, I'm sorry, It was all the civil servants' fault. We need to restructure certain parts of the civil service to make sure this doesn't happen again. And that's we should accept that. And I think that he's massively, massively misjudged this again. But it would be interesting to see where the polling goes, because we've seen the polling for the Tories creep up actually over the last week. Not to a huge extent, but there were some polls where there was, you know, 2 or 3 points was gained back. But whenever Boris Johnson seems to speak on the matter, it drops again. So it'll be interesting to see where that's at. But it was just really bizarre, really, really strange to watch.
Deborah, what was your thoughts?
Well, it was the investigation into alleged gathering on government premises during COVID restrictions is the official title.
And catchy title, isn't it?
I know, it's, yeah, it really rolls off the tongue. And it was more of an update to a document than, you know, the full report, as you pointed out. There wasn't many details. That's what I sort of was like, oh. But the things that were sort of new and shocking was some of the things Brian mentioned. Excessive drinking during work hours. And that was one of the recommendations that gets looked into. The other thing was making it easier for whistleblowers.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was quite, So there's some acknowledgement about that. But also when she says that she has more information, so it's paragraph 15, and it says, in respect of the gatherings that the Metropolitan Police has assessed as not reaching the threshold for criminal investigation, they have not requested any limitations to be placed on the description of those events. However, I have decided not to publish factual accounts in relation to those 4 dates. I do not feel that I am able to do so without detriment to the overall balance of the findings. I was like, what does that even mean? You're not telling us some stuff because it might make us think the Prime Minister's get, like, I have no idea what that, can somebody explain that to me?
No, I was hoping you were going to explain
that. I was hoping, I really hope you're going to keep this going and explain.
But if you, this is meant to be a fact-finding mission, is it not? She's saying here, I've got these facts, but I'm not putting them into the findings. That totally bamboozled me.
That sounds to me like she's been told not to put them in. Mm-hmm. And been told, don't say, you've been told not to put them in. So she's hitting out to some bizarre, convoluted reason as to why she's withheld it.
Yeah. And the final thing was just in the final conclusion part, that basically none of these events can be justified.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting. But Boris Johnson, when he done his speech today, his opening words, I'm sorry, I'm so terribly, terribly sorry. I just felt it was really insincere. I loved all the MPs' comments that were against him. One of his own
backbenchers came out who used to be really supportive of him, and then told him to get to Hannah Bardell, as you mentioned. Did you hear Zara Sultana?
Mm-hmm.
That was quite moving. Like, oh no, it wasn't Zara Sultana, sorry. Another Labour MP mentioned one of the youngest victims of COVID.
Yeah, I did hear that.
I forgot the woman's name, I'm sorry.
It was quite hard to keep track. I found that as well, mm-hmm. because the feed I was showing, it wasn't putting up the names. You were having to mm-hmm. try and catch speakers then. There was a Tory MP that he was actually quite, you could see he was holding back tears. And mm-hmm. asked his name, I looked him up, his name's Alan Bell.
Yeah.
And he asked the Prime Minister, like, explained how his grandmother had died and only 10 at a funeral, and he drove up and he wasn't able to hug his family, and he wasn't able to go to the house for a cup of tea after it, and he'd drive back. And he said, at the end, he said, does the Prime Minister think I was a fool for following these guidelines? And it was just like, when one of his own came up in the hard like that, I thought he could be in trouble here.
Mm-hmm. It would be a real slap in the face for Boris Johnson if it ended up with enough letters to trigger a leadership election after his bravado in the House of Commons today, because I think, like I said, I think he's played this one totally wrong, but I think that he's actually now potentially going to piss enough people off that it could actually trigger a leadership election. And wouldn't that just be a beautiful transition from the anger that was in the House of Commons today? I think
It was interesting to see who did stand up to defend them, because clearly that was orchestrated and planned. One of them, I forgot the guy's name, it was the guy who only recently was like getting investigated for sexual harassment and sexual misconduct. And he was like, I thought, well, if that's one of the people, if you had your choice to have people defending you, you'd probably have him near the back of the queue. So I think that says there wasn't that many people willing to stick their neck out for him.
I think we've got to mention Ian Blackford. I thought he'd done stellar. He was saying everything that we were all thinking. And then when he ended on, the Prime Minister misled this Parliament. And then Lindsay Coyle was like, you must withdraw or leave. And he decided not to withdraw. And he says, well, if he inadvertently misled Parliament, then I'll change it to that. But I thought it was good. I was annoyed, like Brian tweeted, when other SNP MPs got a chance to speak. But I did see Martin Doherty Hugh. He was jumping out of his seat every opportunity he did. I thought he was going to launch over the front bench. And I think he was quite eager because he had walked out with Ian Blackford, if you watched the wee video. I'm no big, huge fan of Ian Blackford, but I thought that was a stellar performance compared to the actual opposition. I thought, did you see what Keir Starmer says?
Before we talk about Keir Starmer, I see the Blackford thing very different from a lot of people I've noticed online. People seem to be quite impressed. I thought it was rubbish. First of all, Theresa May had spoke just before him, and he spent the first 20 seconds basically kissing Theresa May's arse, which I was like, well, why are you spending time keeping praise on the last? I read the story of the Prime Minister. And then he got into the rammy with the Speaker, which I felt took the focus away from Boris Johnson. And it went on way too long. See, if the plan was to get thrown out, which I think that's quite legitimate, if you want to say, no, he's a liar, he is a liar, and I don't care if you throw me out. But it went on where he like half sort of, it was going on. And then to me, it looked as if he shat it and kind of halfway through it. And then it was like as if he went, oh no, wait, no, maybe I should get thrown out, and brought it up again.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was about to get thrown out and he walked it. So he wasn't actually thrown out. He left before they actually, you know, officially done it. And I was like, how hard is it to get thrown out if that was the plan? He total bungled it. I just didn't think, I don't know, I just wasn't impressed at all. I thought Theresa May was more effective that spoke just before.
Theresa May, like obviously everyone on social media giving Theresa May the, you know, the finger clicks and whatever for her, you know, standing up to Boris Johnson. But what's really interesting about Theresa May is this is personal vendetta for Theresa May, because Boris Johnson was one of the key players that basically brought down Theresa May as the Prime Minister, and, you know, constructively over a few years disarmed Theresa May and made moves to become Prime Minister. So for Theresa May, I think this is more personal than actually the benefits of other people. And I just want to, you know, just echo what David was saying, that Ian Blackford was sort of like, oh, you know, Theresa May said this, and, you know, it's great to see this to some extent. And I was a bit like, okay, you've kind of delegitimised yourself before you even started. Because we just need to remember just how vile Theresa May was as a Home Secretary and as a Prime Minister, particularly towards people of colour, asylum seekers, immigrants. So Theresa May was ultimately laid the foundations for the hostile environment and led to the horrendous Windrush scandal. So, you know, when people are clicking their fingers and talking about Theresa May, you're just sort of like, take a minute to stalk. And if Theresa May is looking like the good person right now, that's how far we've come. So, you know, let's just take stock, step back. And I think Ian Blackford tried to swing big today. And I think he was effective to some extent. He's obviously got a lot of people cheering him on social media and all these types of things. Great, good for him. I'm not a huge fan. And yeah, I don't think I think it's almost like, yeah, he shat it, or it's almost like he just didn't think his plan through. And it would have been really, really effective if Ian Blackford had said, really, really short and snap, you're a liar. The Speaker would have said, you need to withdraw that. He should have said no. And then all the SNPs should have stood up and left together. And that would have been a really, really strong statement. But I understand why some of the SNP MPs would have wanted to stay to say what they did, people like Hannah Burdell and things like that. But at the same time, I think that would have been a really, really powerful message of, this is a farce. We're standing up. We're out here. This is ridiculous.
I think everybody that came after Keir Starmer, though, done better than Keir Starmer. Like, I wasn't that impressed with what he had to say, but I thought it was disgraceful, the comment from Boris Johnson. Mm-hmm. That was low hit.
Yeah, desperation.
What comment were you talking about?
Regarding when he was investigating Jimmy Savile.
Oh, the Jimmy Savile one. It was kind of hard to kind of pick out, because, I mean, the premise was, like, desperate. It was a desperate performance. I mean, he kept bringing up, like, Brexit and Vladimir Putin.
It took him an hour and 8 minutes to mention Brexit. Sorry to interrupt your flow there. But I was listening for it.
You know, like, he just kept going back and it was just throwing whatever he could. And then there was a question about, you know, excessive drink was identified with excessive drug use. And he just was like, oh, no. They take drugs. it was the weirdest actual interaction I've actually seen in the House of Commons, where, like the Labour ones were like, oh. What's that supposed to mean?
But the thing is,
it did make me wonder if there's rumours about somebody in the Labour front bench that he was preparing to.
If people in the Labour front bench are taking drugs, then can we just revisit drugs and how we regulate drugs? You know, it's the same situation. You know, we know that there's been all the front bench of the Tories during the 2017 or the 2019 general election saying, yeah, we've taken drugs, we've done this, we've done that. And if they're going to accuse the front bench of the Labour Party doing it again, then is that not then, okay, well, drug use is, you know, rife across the House of Commons, which, you know, from other discussions that we've already had. So perhaps it's time we revisit how we regulate drugs and how we manage drugs through a public health lens, basically. So instead of someone look at this, he said, she said, they're taking drugs and maybe folk in Downing Street were taking drugs. It's just so frustrating.
Talking about Starmer as well, I think he was rubbish. Do you know, I don't think I went back and listened to what he said a couple of times, because he forgot to say that he forgot to call for Johnson to resign.
I don't think he forgot.
He said it in Twitter right after, so I think he honestly did forget to say it.
I liked what Hugh Williams of Plaid Cymru said, that the Prime Minister's backbenchers should discover their backbones and sack them. I don't think he's going anywhere. I think that it's just going to be an inquiry into the inquiry, and then there'll be, you know, further research into what the appropriate actions are. Like, it's just going to keep getting kicked down the road, and there's just going to be constantly a wee sort of Anderson shelter for the Prime Minister to hide in. I thought it was interesting how quickly Russia was mentioned, though.
The other thing about Starmer as well is, I thought he just sounded so weak. Like you said about the guy from Plaid Cymru, who, like, kind of had a jab at the Tory backbenchers as they say, you should get rid of this guy. Whereas Keir Starmer sounded like he was begging. Like, he was begging the Tory backbenchers. Like, and it was like saying, oh, well, I mean, there's nothing I can do about it because I'm just spineless and useless. But please, gonna you do something about this terrible man? Mm-hmm. You know, just like, and then he quoted Thatcher as well. So,
So you've got the leader of the opposition quoting Thatcher. You've got the leader of the SNP congratulating Theresa May. It's just, I found it a really weird, I honestly didn't expect it to go the way that it did. Like, I was just like, come on, this has seriously got to be the time where something's going to happen. But I think it really just exemplifies Westminster politics when the only people that can actually do anything immediately to get rid of the Prime Minister is Tory backbenchers. They have to get rid of him because there's such a big majority that the, you know, a vote of no confidence would be unlikely. Wouldn't it be nice to try, though? Just saying. Maybe just test the water.
I think it will be interesting. The Tory backbenchers will digest what happened today in his performance, and then they'll come to a decision. So if he's still in place by the time this podcast comes out, he'll still be in place for a wee while yet, because they'll go back and discuss it, and they might be quite embarrassed with his performance, in which case they might decide to pull the plug on him.
I hope so.
That will happen quickly, I think. So wait and see. We'll move on to our next topic then. So Labour's only MP, Ian Murray, has made another valiant attempt to save the union. He's urged the head of the civil service in the UK to step in and stop the Scottish Government from planning for an independent Scotland. Nicola Sturgeon announced in the programme for government last year that civil servants would resume work and a plan for how Scotland would look outside the UK. And it emerged this week that 11 civil servants had been tasked with creating the prospectus. On Sunday, Ian Murray wrote to the Cabinet Secretary, the head of the civil service in the UK, calling for an investigation that will ultimately reverse the decision. So, Ian Murray, what about you, Deborah?
Is Ian Murray the guy that asked where the oil fund will come from? Do you remember that?
I forgot that. Was that Ian Murray?
Trying to find if it was, but it sounds like something Ian Murray would say. I just think he's a bit of an idiot. He's always campaigning for, you know, the union. I think he's more unionist than many Tory unionists. Like, he's a bizarre man. First of all, civil servants get paid to do the job for the government, and last recall, SNP got voted into government, and the Greens are there, and they both support independence, so this is work civil servants should be doing. I think it's a cheek he's got writing to... Who was it he wrote to, sorry, when I was searching, I missed it.
Simon Case, the Cabinet Secretary, head of the civil service.
Like, as if the guy's not got enough on his plate.
There was some good quotes, like you were just kind of to paraphrase what you said. There was a quote: civil servants exist to support their ministers, and like it or not, it is the Scottish Government's policy to pursue independence via a second IndyRef. That was from former Tory MSP Adam Tompkins.
My God. So, don't tell me I sound like a Tory.
Well, in this instance, so Adam Tompkins thinks Ian Murray's just out of order with this move, you know. There was also a quote from one of his Labour colleagues, Neil Finlay, that said, the position of Ian Murray has taken is absurd.
Succinct.
So the unionists are putting the boot into him, so we don't have to, but we could do it anyway, right?
Hi, Ian Murray, with that massive mandate that Scottish Labour has, with the one MP in Scotland after they lost their other MPs at the last general election. Ian Murray, unfortunately, is going to be around for a while, because he even kept his seat in 2015, and which is, you know, to his credit, clearly what his constituents are looking for. So, you know, tactically voting Labour to keep Ian Murray representing them. So thanks for that. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. So you've got an elected MP of a political party that only has one representative, and that is, you know, dwindled in support at Holyrood over the last, you know, 20 years of devolution, constantly reducing in size, who feels it to take it upon himself to contact unelected civil servants to stop the work of the elected government that won at the last election. It's pretty interesting, and I think that we'll be seeing Ian Murray in the House of Lords at some point, just to keep that that view of democracy and democracy in action in place. But yeah, I just think Ian Murray's just showed his arse this time, I think. And even other people are just basically saying, what are you doing? Like, you're actually embarrassing yourself. Stop doing this. Because it's just kind of got to a ridiculous stage when it comes to Ian Murray. You know, that image that crops up on social media all the time, him with the Union Jack suit on, always makes me laugh, because I think it really just...
Because he hates nationalism.
He hates nationalism, and he's literally wearing this suit that is just a giant Union Jack. It's fantastic. A lot of people hate nationalism when it's not the nationalism that they like, don't they? Which is always quite an interesting perspective, particularly when it comes to uber nationalists within Scottish Labour, as in Brit nationalists and Tories in general.
I don't think I don't think he listens to the show, Ian Murray. But Ian, if you're listening, I've got a bit of advice. See if you don't want civil servants implementing SNP policies. I've got an idea. You could try winning an election. That would do it. Then you could tell them to implement your policies. Because that's the way it works. That's the way democracy works. That's the way the government works. So hope he's writing that down. It's a podcast where you can rewind it and listen to it again if you didn't quite catch all that, Ian. So good luck to you. Aye. Ian Murray, I mean, it seems to be, I think all politicians have this a wee bit in terms of a bit of an ego. But there's a certain strain within the Labour Party. I think it's even more extreme, but they're all so convinced of their own genius. And Ian Murray is the MP because of an accent of geography that even when the whole national picture has changed, there is an area that has managed to keep some kind of Labour majority within that. Seemingly it's helped a wee bit because he was very supportive of Hearts Football Club when they were in financial trouble, and that's got him a bit of a vote out of that. But he thinks he's still an MP. We know that his Labour colleagues lost their seats because he's just so brilliant and he's such a quality MP. In fact, he thought he was so good that he thought about joining Change UK, apparently. Mm-hmm. Seemingly he was very close to defecting.
That would have been funny.
That would have been brilliant. Yeah. I really wish he'd done it. Just shows you he doesn't always make stupid decisions.
Not all the time.
Maybe from his perspective, though, because he is so uber British nationalist, that this is an affront to British democracy. You know, maybe he is doing it for just a very blinkered viewpoint.
I'd say probably a very imperialist viewpoint. Yeah. You know, like the Scottish government can only work as far as he thinks it doesn't conflict with the UK government.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's important to point out, just to get a bit of a context on Ian Murray as well, that Ian Murray resigned as Shadow Scottish Secretary under Jeremy Corbyn, confirming his decision that he feels that he had voiced concerns about Jeremy Corbyn before he became leader and was undermining Jeremy Corbyn while he was leader. So, and if he was considering joining Change UK, well, I think we could kind of guess where Ian Murray is on the scale of Labour to New Labour. Maybe.
To the right, to the right.
I just want to say, though, when I was giving him the advice about winning elections, that was in no way a dig at the fact that he stood for deputy leadership and came fourth. I just want to say that. I wasn't even in a jab. I wasn't having a jab the fact that he only get 13% of the vote. Okay, I'm just, why put that out there? Explain my position.
Mm-hmm. Ian Murray is, it's nice to have him around sometimes just for a laugh, but, you know, let's say.
His fashion choices.
Fashion choices, his how he speaks with such conviction when he's the only MP in Scotland for Labour is really funny. Yeah. Like, I think it takes a lot of ego to be able to do that.
Some brass neck.
He's got a scrappy do on UK politics, hasn't he?
Aye, very much so. But aye,
Ian Murray, found the name of the podcast.
The scrappy do.
The scrappy do of UK politics. Okay, and now a word from our sponsor.
Our sponsor this week is Sense of Nature Pet Service, based in central Scotland. Sense of Nature gives you a hands-on, personalised experience with a variety of exciting creatures, from snakes and skunks to tarantulas and turtles. Sense of Nature has something for everyone. They offer sensory sessions, one-to-one and group sessions, educational encounters for children of all ages, and they are available for private events upon inquiry. Animal welfare is at the forefront of everything they do, and if appropriate, a risk assessment can be carried out at no additional cost prior to your booking. To get 5% off your next booking with Sense of Nature, quote Holyrood Ungagged 5 at time of booking. To contact Sense of Nature, you can do so by email on sense.of.natureinquiries@outlook.com. You can also find them on most social media platforms by searching for Sense of Nature.
Next on our agenda, we're going to talk about the ongoing and upcoming cost of living crisis. National insurance is due to go up by 1.25 percentage points in April. Inflation, the rate at which prices are increasing, is already at a 30-year high, reaching 5.4% this month. Energy bills are also set to rise when the government price cap rises in April, with a rise in train fares. Council tax is likely to go up, and everybody's talking about this a lot more due to Jack Monroe, who created a Twitter thread that quickly became a campaign when she explained that a lot of the cheapest foodstuff, the prices on them had rocketed far beyond the standard inflation. So much so that the Office of National Statistics have announced that they'll make changes to how they calculate inflation. So, Brian.
Yeah, cost of living crisis is one of the things that unfortunately is going under the radar because of this sort of fuckwittery that's going on in Westminster at the moment, and the Tories showing their arse as usual. You know, and it's almost been used as, we want to talk about the really important issues, we want to talk about the rising cost of living, yet the Prime Minister won't resign so we can start doing that. So that aside, for the time being, if the Prime Minister was to go, we'd be able to get on with actually trying to solve these issues. But the only way we're going to be able to do that is by removing this government and replacing them with a radical government, not one that's currently the current leader of the opposition. So just, you know, the way inflation is calculated, I think it's really good that Jack Munro done the thread that she done, because it made it very, very clear that how there's so much bias and how inflation is calculated. I think inflation almost feels quite alien to a lot of people because it's like, oh, well, it's 5.4% as opposed to 3% in 1992 or whatever it might be. And it's so alien. But I think what a lot of people's experiences of the cost of living rising is, we've noticed a sharp increase. And I would say over the last couple of years since Brexit, particularly with the cost of food specifically, we know that there's a huge rise in the cost of gas, which is going to be a huge impact, which is regulated at the moment until April. And then we're going to see a huge and significant rise in heat in our homes for those who have gas. And there's so many other real key things here, but Jack Munro really focuses on food because that is obviously where her campaign started all these years ago in 2011. And she was interviewed on BBC News, and basically that food shop that she had done for the Sunday People, which was that £10 shop, so she could create these recipes to feed a family. And basically that now costs over £17 in the case of what, 11 years or whatever it is, which is huge. It's massive. And that's not 5.4% increase. And, you know, she pointed to a lot of supermarkets removing a lot of basic ranges from a lot of the supermarkets and making it much more challenging. I mean, I think it was pasta was, you know, the lowest one that you could get in Asda was 29 pence, and then that's now 70 pence. And if you keep applying these things to things like rice, dried food, all these types of things, and then you don't even consider some of the things which I've noticed a huge, massive increase, fruit, veg, all these types of things, massive, massive jump. And it's people who is on the ground and people who are struggling and those who have to access food banks. These are the types of people we need to be getting data from, because these people are all too aware of how much things cost and how much the prices have risen. And I think it's really good that Jack Munro's campaign has been taken so far as to the ONS to be taking our perspective on board, and they are looking at reevaluating how inflation is actually calculated, which I think is a really, really positive thing. But I think the main thing that's come out of Jack Munro's campaign is how many people are actually behind this. And this kind of falls into a lot of discussions that have been kind of peppered throughout the pandemic, like things like free school meals, for example, all these types of things. When we talk about these really, really important issues, and it's about access to food, right? And food should be a human right, in my opinion, and people should have access to, you know, somewhere safe to live, food to keep them, you know, keep them alive, and have a good quality of life. And when we look at food poverty and we look at food bank usage and these really horrible statistics where there's more food banks now in the UK than there is McDonald's across the UK, and we know how often we see McDonald's when you're out and about or driving around, and when you put these types of things in black and white so people can understand them, that's where you can get people really on board to back what it is that you want to change. But I just wish that this government would be listening to people like Jack Munro and actually making policy choice that will prevent the cost of living spiraling out of control, and that is specifically around the gas prices that were just going to go skyrocket in April.
Yeah. Also in April, there's the national insurance hike.
Yep.
That's going to be double whammy for folk. Yeah, I agree with you what you were saying, but Jack Munro is amazing. I really like Jack, and I remember that £10 campaign she'd done because I was in benefits at the time, and you know, I had low income, and I found it very valuable, lots of really good tips and information. The thing I want to talk about though is something that I've not seen much spoken about, and that's basic household essentials. Stuff like bleach, Dettol, cleaning stuff, toiletries. These little things that used to always be on offer, special offer, because I'm one of the people who I don't really have brand loyalty. I'll buy whatever's on offer that day, except with coffee. Got to have decent coffee. But even then, I'll still buy the one on the best offer. But those offers have doubled in price. Mm-hmm. So things that used to be under a pound, maybe 80 pence, that's now like over a pound, mm-hmm. which doesn't seem that much a hike. But if that's something you've got to buy all the time, the prices have also increased. So it's not just the food. It's also all those other essentials. And one thing that I did want to mention was about when you are given to food banks, they appreciate stuff like sanitary stuff, mm-hmm. baby wipes. I know they aren't really environmentally friendly, but for a lot of folks, especially disabled people, they're really an essential item. They're mm-hmm. not like a luxury. And the Scottish Government's done the new app, Pick Up Your Period, mm-hmm. Where you can get free, you can find locations around the place if you need free sanitary stuff. Also, there's a big boost just now happening in community fridges. Mm-hmm. And I would urge you all to write to your MSPs and councillors. And I think it's Co-op has got a sort of network going just now with community fridges. So get involved in those things. I know it sounds like it's all doom and gloom because we're saying everything, oh, the price has gone up and that. And it is. But the best way to combat this, I'm sorry to say, it's independence. I really do think that we need to get back into Europe, get those channels open so we're not waiting, you know, weeks and weeks in bananas that are then £3 for a bunch of bananas.
I've noticed the price has gone up. You know, I'm not on a particularly low income, but we have a big household. There's 7 years in the household. So we buy a lot of shopping. And obviously you then notice the sort of small margins. It's more extreme when you're buying a lot of stuff. And it's towards the end of the month when you suddenly realise and you think, why have I got so little money left when you're thinking I've not really had any big expenditures this month? And it's just all the sort of general expenditures have all just edged up a wee bit. One of the other things is like fuel costs. Like I filled up my car and it came to £84. And I just thought, I've never, that's definitely, I think now it's creeped over the £80 mark. It's suddenly like, oh my God. Which is pretty good that from today young people have got free public transport in Scotland if you're under 22, because I mean a lot of people will not be viable to run a car in that kind of expense.
Sure.
Sorry, before I forget, the other expense increase that I've noticed is, see, if you have special dietary requirements, all those prices are now like, oh my God, that's too expensive, I'm not going to buy that. I'm not gluten intolerant, but I was looking at the gluten-free wraps and I was like, why are they so much more expensive than regular wraps? It didn't, that blew my mind because if I think some, is it celiacs they're called? They can get prescriptions for special foods, but that's no use if you're just in a family shop and you're trying to get some stuff. The same with oat milk, almond milk, mm-hmm. these things that used to be on par, maybe a few pence more expensive than Coos milk, that's now a wee £2 for just, you know, a wee carton. I'm like, I'll just get a rash for drinking Coos milk.
I think a lot of that is because some of these things became sort of trendy as well. Like, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people decided they were gluten free, and it was like, well, there's people that are gluten free because they have a serious medical condition, but mm-hmm. a lot of people just kind of declared themselves that they couldn't eat gluten. And it's, I think a lot of the foods now have become sort of seen as something that can be marketed rather than, you know, something that's needed by certain people because of medical
reasons.
I think I gave
oat milk. Let's see, more of a lifestyle choice, mm-hmm. which some people might be treating it that way, but for the people that don't have that choice, it's hell of inconvenient. The only thing you can eat is suddenly getting marketed and having the price jacked up.
That was another important point. If you are donating to food banks just now, they'd have folk who come with dietary requirements as well. So if you're getting soya milk or, I don't know, dairy-free cheese or vegan cheese now, mm-hmm. that sort of stuff, then they really appreciate those sort of donations.
Yeah, for sure. And just, you know, going back to like the sort of discussion around the cost of living, I mean, we know fuel's going up, we know food's going up and all these different things, but I think it's really important when we talk about the people who are reliant on accessing food banks or accessing, you know, the sort of this cheaper food from supermarkets, is that they tend to live in really precarious accommodation. So their cost of living when it comes to their house prices is a lot higher and a lot more precarious, and that is continuing to rise as well. But then it even comes down to the simplicity of where a lot of people that will have privilege is that people can afford to buy in bulk, okay? Mm-hmm. And people that live on, like, have a lot less disposable income can't afford to do that, or a lot of people don't have the facilities to do that. So if you don't have a big freezer, you've only got this wee letterbox freezer, you can't bulk buy frozen food, which generally works out a lot cheaper. And, you know, for me, and I've experienced that at different times in my life where I've not been able to bulk buy things. But if you do, if you're in a position and you have that privilege to be able to bulk buy things that you use often, then you will benefit from that. You will find it cheaper. Whereas people that live week to week, day to day, don't have that luxury and therefore have to end up paying more for the sort of basic essentials that people with privilege can actually benefit from. And these are the types of things that when it comes to employment precarity, housing precarity, but also just having that ability to be able to bulk buy actually helps people reduce their week-to-week cost of living. And so many people just don't have that privilege to be able to do that.
I've just got to say, I think Jack Monro is coming up with a new price index. He's sort of more accurately reflect it, and it's called the Vimes Boots Index.
That's
based off a character, Vimes, from a Terry Pratchett novel who tells a story, and you just reminded me there about how, like, if you get money, it's cheaper when you're buying boots, because, you know, if you buy good boots, they'll last you for years. Whereas if you don't get money, you have to buy the cheap boots that don't last nearly as long, and that means you need to buy another set of boots, maybe several sets of boots, when if you just spent a wee bit more at the start on the good boots, you would have saved money. So it's expensive being poor.
There's also the issue of prepaid card meters for power.
Yes, that they're massively. They're often
at a much higher rate. And if you're in debt to the meter, like if you went into emergency, you pressed your button, you've then got to spend a huge chunk of your income on getting it back to zero for it to be any use. The disparity as well between heating systems in people's homes, like you said, some people's accommodation is really precarious, but also some people have still got old-fashioned electric storage heaters, which are really inefficient. Like, there's some people who are in more modern social housing, they've maybe got air pumps, and maybe they've got some sort of supplementary PV solar or something to run their house. But a lot of people who are in private rented accommodation, they can't get any of this, and they might have inefficient boilers. Their landlords might not have applied for the government grants. They might not have double glazed windows or triple glazed windows. They might not have insulated roofs. All these different factors, as you say, that was it Grimes Boots? What was it?
Vimes.
Vimes Boots. That's how I'd be so interested to read about that, because everything you're saying, totally agree with you. The poorer you are, more expensive it is to live.
For sure. And everybody hates, you know, the campaign of Insulate Britain, you know, because of their tactics or whatever. But their basic principle is, please insulate our homes. Please make our homes, you know, more sustainable so we don't have to use as much fuel. And this campaign has never been connected to the massive rise in gas which is coming in, and it's just, to me, it's crazy, because, you know, you can agree or disagree with you know, the campaign techniques of Insulate Britain or how they communicate their message, but at the same time they're saying we should insulate our homes, and at the same time, you know, a couple of months later the cost of gas is going to go through the roof. It's going to benefit those who don't have as much. They don't have access to food. They don't have access to secure homes in the sense that it's going to keep them warm. So to me, it's like, you know, if the government was preemptive and planning ahead, which we know they're not, and actually insulating homes, making homes safe and a permanent place to keep people warm, then perhaps this huge sharp rise in the cost of gas wouldn't actually be impacting on people so much, because they would have warm homes that they wouldn't have to constantly keep pumping gas through their boilers to keep warm, because the buildings are so inefficient.
Yeah, I mean, insulating houses to make them more efficient seems like such a common sense, like run-of-the-mill idea that, and so uncontroversial, you wouldn't think people would have to lie in motorways to get the government to do it. But nothing seems to make sense in Britain in 2022.
Nope.
Okay, we're going to move on now to our final item of the week. The Scottish Government has been urged to pause its reforms to the gender recognition process for further consideration. Ministers want to change the system to make it easier for people to change their legally recognised gender, and a bill is expected at Holyrood this year. But the Equality and Human Rights Commission has told them that more detailed consideration is needed. The government has already conducted two consultations in the plans, but apparently that's not enough for the EHRC. Deborah, thoughts?
I would like just one single day where our trans siblings aren't fucking attacked. That would be amazing. Just one day, one single day. I was sent the EHRC thing and I was working, so I didn't really read it. I just thought, oh, they're transphobic nonsense. But then I read it and I was like, what are they talking about? There's been two consultations, as you rightly said. And these people's voices, they're no many. They are few, right? They really are. They are very few, but they're fucking persistent and annoying and doing my nut right in. Please, Brian, talk, because I'm not going to make sense. I'm actually seething. I need to go and take a wee glass of water before I continue.
Okay, Deborah, you enjoy your water. Brian will pick up the rant.
Yeah, very similar to when I read that thread or whatever it was from the AHRC. I mean, was it surprising from the AHRC? Yes, it is technically, because they originally supported GRE reform before, but then there was a change at the top from a certain political party that happens to be in power at Westminster, and now they've changed their position, which is quite interesting. But the Scottish equivalent to the AHRC has come out, I think it was yesterday or the day before, basically reaffirming their position, which has continually been to support the change to the Gender Recognition Act, and also in for making conversion therapy, and I say that in inverted commas, to ban that completely. So, you know, the AHRC can continue doing whatever it is that they want to do. Can you just give us a break? Like, you know, Deborah's really articulately said, because trans, non-binary, genderqueer people are just exhausted. Allies are exhausted. Everybody's exhausted. You know, women are exhausted because they are the ones that are being gaslit to believe that you know, making it easier for trans people to be who they want to be is somehow going to impact on their rights, or it's somehow going to impact on their safety, or it's somehow going to impact on, you know, the experiences of women in prisons, when actually what we need to be questioning is, why are so many women in prison? Why is there so many people in prison? You know, let's really take a step back and look at these real societal issues that we've got, rather than let's keep the status quo exactly how it is, and the oppression of women and the oppression of all these minorities and the people of colour, but let's just exclude trans folk from that as well. That's basically what the position of those people who are, in very commas, gender critical, and you know, try to perpetuate the current status quo. Fuck that. I'm really, you know, queer liberation, the liberation of trans people is going to be a liberation for so many other minorities. So let's just get on with these very, very small asks that the gender recognition encompasses. Let's make it easier. Let's just make it so they don't have to go and get the doctor to say it's okay for them to change gender. Let's, you know, they don't have to live as that gender for 2 years and have it documented, and, you know, all these invasive questions and processes and costs that they need to incur for this. Let's just allow them that to live how they want to live and have access to a gender recognition certificate that reflects the gender that they are. Let's just allow them that. And then, you know, all these organisations who are trying to steal headlines, fan a moral panic, just stop it. We're all tired, especially trans, non-binary and genderqueer people.
Yeah.
They're tired and allies are exhausted. Let's just get this legislation into the Scottish Parliament. Let's allow this to be debated, and then actually let the MSPs who are elected to the Scottish Parliament to vote on it, because it's going to pass. So let's just get this done. It's been going on for long enough, and really, how many consultations do you need?
Yeah,
the EHRC said that, like, part of their thinking why it needed more consideration, because they were concerned about the quote polarizing debate. Surely that's an argument for not dragging it out even more. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason that general transphobia has rocketed is because this has been getting debated for what, 6-7 years, something mm-hmm. like that, and it's like, all you're doing is giving a platform to this tiny wee sort of group of bigots so that they can keep perpetuating a lot of misconceptions and scare stories. And if we just get it past, people will forget about it because they'll realise that, oh no, actually no, all these terrible things that were whipped up to be terrified of is not came to pass, because they've not came to pass in any of the other countries that have done it. I think it was somewhere like 2003 that Ireland passed a similar act. I think Ireland's perfectly safe for women. I don't think women's rights have been eroded due to that.
What you were saying, Brian and David, exactly. For these folks to keep going on about the identity of strangers, right? They don't really care about these people being able to access identification that matches their identity. Like, it really is one of the most tedious and misrepresented arguments in all of Scottish politics, in my opinion, that the actual public perception of this is, of course we want trans people to have the same rights as everybody else. But as soon as you get into some sort of discourse and there's a gender critical, inverted commas, person there, everything all changes because they make it to the extreme. And did the EHRC not bring up something about trans people in sports? Was there not something mentioned?
I think they brought up some of the...
the dog whistles?
This general talking points.
The general sort of myths that keep getting perpetuated about it.
Because I've got a real question. Why is there not more trans people in sport?
Because they're excluded.
Exactly. This is a continuous attack. It's just an assault, a relentless assault on some of the most vulnerable and victimised folk in our community. And I'm absolutely fed up with it. It's just, we need to get GRA reform sorted so that Scotland is a progressive, inclusive, modern country that is in line with other countries right across the world.
As soon as we get the GRA reform through, there needs to be a focus on trans healthcare, and we need to start including trans people in that discussion so we can get healthcare that reflects their needs. And we also have to, you know, start preparing our local authorities and our parliaments so they can be more inclusive for trans people. And political parties, all political parties, I'll let the Scottish Greens off with this one because they seem to be the only party that I'm aware of that actually generally has very zero tolerance to transphobia. Scottish Green.
Don't mention the English Green Party.
Well, I said Scottish Green Party that seem to be have the correct stance on this, where they are led by their members. They have unequivocally support trans, non-binary, and genderqueer people to be who they are, and that's, you know, is part of the basis of their fundamental, the pillars of their green politics. And they themselves are calling out the Green Party of England and Wales, which is great. It's exactly how it should be, because there's a lot of good people in the Green Party of England and Wales, but they need to do more to stamp out transphobia. But anyway, going back to the point, let's get the GRA sorted so we can get, you know, trans people a little bit more dignity in their life and be able to be who they want to be. And then let's start focusing on actually the really important things, which is about trans healthcare and about eradicating the hate which has been built up over years and years over this sort of NAF debate. And bear in mind, the GRA reform was actually in all the manifestos of the political manifestos in 2016. Okay, that was voted in 2016. And here we are, 2022, and EHRC, well, we need to talk about it more. Well, actually, no, we didn't. We need to just get on with this. And then we need to start talking about the real substantial issues when it comes to trans, non-binary, and genderqueer people, so they feel included and that they get the healthcare that they need.
Trans rights are human rights.
I do wonder if the EHRC are they just really being completely disingenuous with this whole, we need to debate it more? Or are they just out of touch completely with the actual reality of the debate and doing that sort of very middle of the road? Oh, you know, let's see if we can just keep everybody happy and we'll just talk about it more. I really don't know enough about them to say one way or the other.
I think there's some really articulate, politically savvy women who have bought into this rhetoric, to be honest. And they cannot come out of that because they don't have, maybe they don't have a connection with queer culture like we do. Like, I don't think all gender critical folk, I keep doing this because it sounds so stupid. I'm critical of gender and all. I don't believe in the binary. But, like, that's not their argument. These women aren't all nefariously motivated, I don't think. I just think they're so out of touch that it's like trying to have a discussion with, I don't know, a great granny about how you shouldn't call all Germans Nazis or something. I don't think all of them are nefarious, but the main sort of
ringleaders.
Aye, Rosie Parker, other names that I can't pick out the air right now, but I'm just thinking of her because you mentioned the Green Party of England and Wales. I don't know how trans folk are feeling, to be honest. They must be completely and utterly scunnered with it all. And I just wish I can't really say much, like, because I'm in the SNP and look at the sort of voices that are in the SNP. So I don't know what can be done. I just want to express my solidarity.
That's all you can do.
And on that note, I think we'll end it there. Thanks for everybody for listening. Brian, Deborah, thank you for joining me. You can find all our podcasts, all episodes of Hollywood Ungagged at leftungagged.org, as well as written articles. There's also a North American-based podcast, monthly podcast called World Beat with George Collins, where he will be interviewing scholars, activists and writers about the state of the world. And we'll have another new podcast on its way, so stay tuned for that. If you have anything that you want to want us to talk about, you can tweet us at _ungagged, #HollywoodUngagged, or you can drop us an email at ungaggedleft@gmail.com, putting Hollywood Ungagged in the subject line. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please go to whatever podcast platform you use and give us 5 stars. So take care, everybody, and we'll hear from you next. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. Thanks for listening. And it was nice to hear you smile. Clean a dream, cause you'll never die. The stars will never overtake the sky. Life has its turns and it takes a while. And it was nice to hear you smile.